In the year 1878, I took my degree of Doctor of Medicine of the University of London and proceeded to Netley to go through the course prescribed for surgeons in the army. Having completed my studies there, I was duly attached to the 5th Northumberland Fusiliers as assistant surgeon. The regiment was stationed in India at the time, and before I could join it, the Second Afghan War had broken out. On landing at Bombay, I learned that my corps had advanced through the passes and was already deep in the enemy's country. I followed, however, with many other officers who were in the same situation as myself and succeeded in reaching Kandahar in safety, where I found my regiment and at once entered upon my new duties. The campaign brought honors and promotion to many, but for me, it had nothing but misfortune and disaster. I was removed from my brigade and attached to the Bashiks, with whom I served at the fatal Battle of Maywand, where I was struck on the shoulder by a Jaizal bullet, which shattered the bone and grazed the subclavian artery. I should have fallen in the hands of murderous Ghazis had not been for the devotion and courage shown by my Murray, my orderly, who threw me across a pack horse and succeeded in bringing me safely to the British lines. Worn with pain and weak from the prolonged hardships which I had undergone, I was removed, with a great train of wounded sufferers, to the base hospital at Peshawar. Here I rallied, and had already improved so far as to be able to walk about the wards, and even to bask a little upon the veranda, where I struck down my enteric fever, that curse of our Indian possessions. For months my life was deprived of, when at least I came to myself and became convalescent. I was so weak and emaciated that a medical board determined that not a day should be lost in sending me back to England. I was dispatched, accordingly, in the troop ship Antilles, and landed a month later at Portsmouth Jetty, where my health irretrievably ruined, but with permission from my paternal government to spend the next 9 months in attempting to improve it. I had neither kith nor kin in England, and was therefore as free as air, or as free as an income of 11 shillings and a sixpence a day will permit a man to be. Under such circumstances, I naturally gravitated to London, that great cesspool into which all the loungers and idlers of the empire are irresistibly drained. There I stayed for some time in a private hotel in the Strand, leading a comfortless, meaningless existence, and spending such money as I had, considerably more freely than I ought. So alarming did the state of my finances become that I soon realized that I must either leave the metropolis and rusticate somewhere in the country, or that I must take a complete alteration in my style of living. Choosing the latter alternative, I began by making up my mind to leave the hotel and to take up my quarters in some less pretentious and less expensive domicile. On the very day that I had come to this conclusion, I was standing at the Criterion bar when someone tapped me on the shoulder, and turning round, I recognized a young Stamford who had been a dresser under me at Bart's. The sight of a friendly face in the great wilderness of London is a pleasant thing indeed to a lonely man. In old days, Stamford had been a particular crony of mine, but now I hailed him with enthusiasm, and he, in his turn, appeared to be delighted to see me. In the exuberance of my joy, I asked him to lunch with me at the Holborn, and we started off in a hansom. "Wherever have you been doing with yourself, Watson?" he asked in undisguised wonder as we rattled through the crowded London streets. "You're as thin as a lath and as brown as a nut." I gave him a short sketch of my adventures, and had hardly concluded it by the time we reached our destination. "Poor devil," he said commiseratingly, after he had listened to my misfortunes. "What are you up to now?" "Looking for lodgings," I answered, trying to solve the problem as to whether it's possible to get comfortable rooms at a reasonable price. "That's a strange thing," remarked my companion. "You're the second man today that's asked that expression to me." "And who is the first?" I asked. "A fellow who is working at the chemical laboratory up at the hospital. He was bemoaning himself this morning because he could not get someone to go halves with him on some nice rooms which he had found, but which were too much for his purse. "By Jove," I cried, "if he really wants someone to share the room and the expense, I'm the very man for him. Should I prefer having a partner to being alone?" Young Stamford looked rather strangely at me over his wine glasses. "You don't know Sherlock Holmes yet," he said. "Perhaps you would not care for him as a constant companion." "Why, what is there against him?" "Oh, I didn't say there was anything against him. He's a little queer in his ideas, an enthusiast in some branches of science. As far as I know, he's a decent fellow enough." "A medical student, I suppose?" said I. "No, I have no idea what he intends to go in for. I believe he's well up in anatomy, and he is a first-class chemist, but, as far as I know, he has never taken out any systematic medical classes. His studies are very desultory and eccentric, but he has amassed a lot of out-of-the-way knowledge which would astonish his professors." "Did you never ask him what he was going in for?" I asked. "No, he's not a man that is easy to draw out, though he can be communicative enough when the fancy seizes him." "I should like to meet him," I said. "If I am to lodge with anyone, I should prefer a man of studious and quiet habits. I am not strong enough yet to stand much noise or excitement. I had enough of both in Afghanistan to last me for the remainder of my natural existence. How could I meet this friend of yours?" "He is sure to be at the laboratory," returned my companion. "He either avoids the place for weeks or else works there from morning till night. If you like, we would drive round together after luncheon." "Certainly," I answered, and the conversation drifted away to other channels. As we made our way to the hospital after leaving the Holborn, Stamford gave me a few more particulars about the gentleman whom I proposed to take as a fellow lodger. "You mustn't blame me if you don't get on with him," he said. "I know nothing more of him than I've learned from meeting him occasionally in the laboratory. You proposed this arrangement, so you must not hold me responsible." "If we don't get on, it will be easy to part company," I answered. "It seems to me, Stamford," I added, looking hard at my companion, "that you have some reason for washing your hands of the matter. Is this fellow's temper so formidable, or what is it? Don't be mealy-mouthed about it." "It's not easy to express the inexpressible," he answered with a laugh. "Holmes is a little too scientific for my taste. It approaches to cold-bloodedness. But I could imagine him giving a friend a little pinch of the latest vegetable alkaloid, not out of malevolence, you understand, but simply out of a spirit of inquiry in order to have an accurate idea of the effects. To do him justice, I think that he would take it himself with the same readiness. He appears to have a passion for definitive and exact knowledge." "Very right, too." "Yes, but it may be pushed to excess. When it comes to beating subjects in the dissecting rooms with a stick, it is certainly taking a rather bizarre shape."
"Beating the subjects?"
"Yes, to verify how far bruises may be produced after death. I saw him at it with my own eyes." "And yet you say he is not a medical student." "No. Heaven knows what the object of his studies are. But here we are, and you must form your own impression about him." As he spoke, we turned down a narrow lane and passed through a small side door which opened into a wing of the great hospital. It was familiar ground to me. I needed no guiding as we ascended the bleak stone staircase and made our way down the long corridor with its vistas of whitewashed wall and dun-colored doors. Near the far end, a low arched passage branched away from it and led to the chemical laboratory. This was a lofty chamber, lined and littered with countless bottles. Broad, low tables were scattered about, which bristled with retorts, test tubes, and little Bunsen lamps with their blue flickering flames. There was only one student in the room, who was bending over a distant table absorbed in his work. At the sound of our footsteps, he glanced round and sprang to his feet with a cry of pleasure. "I found it! I found it!" he shouted to my companion, running towards us with a test tube in his hand. "I found a reagent which is precipitated by hemoglobin, and by nothing else." He had discovered a gold mine. Greater delight could not have shone upon his features. "Dr. Watson, Mr. Sherlock Holmes," said Stamford, introducing us. How are you? He said cordially, gripping my hand with a strength for which I had hardly have given him credit. You have been in Afghanistan, I perceive. How on earth did you know that? I asked in astonishment. Never mind, said he, chuckling to himself. The question now is about hemoglobin. No doubt you see the significance of this discovery of mine. It is interesting, chemically, no doubt, I answered. But practically, why, man, what is the most practical medical legal discovery for years? Don't you see it gives us an infallible test for blood stains? Come over here now. He seized me by the coat sleeve in his eagerness and drew me over to the table at which he had been working. Let us have some fresh blood, he said, digging a long bloodkin into his finger and drawing off the resulting drop of blood in a chemical pipette. Now I add a small quantity of blood to a liter of water. You perceive that the resulting mixture has the appearance of pure water. The proportion of blood cannot be more than 1 in 1,000,000. I have no doubt, however, that we shall be able to attain the characteristic reaction. As he spoke, he threw into the vessel a few white crystals, then added some drops of a transparent fluid. In an instant, the contents assumed a dull mahogany color, and a brownish dust was precipitated in the bottom of the glass jar. Aha! He cried, clapping his hands and looking as delighted as a child with a new toy. What do you think of that? It seems to be a very delicate test, I remarked. Beautiful, beautiful. The old Goeckim test is very clumsy and uncertain. So is the microscopic examination for blood corpuscles. The latter is valueless, as the stains are a few hours old. Now, this appears to act well whether the blood is old or new. Had the test been invented, there are hundreds of men now walking the earth who would have long ago been paid the penalty for their crimes. Indeed, I murmured. Criminal cases are continually hinging upon that point. A man is suspected of a crime months perhaps after it has been committed. His linen or clothes are examined and brownish stains discovered upon them. Are they blood stains, or mud stains, or rust stains, or fruit stains, or what are they? That is the question which has puzzled many an expert. And why? Because there is no reliable test. Now I have the Sherlock Holmes test, and there will no longer be any difficulty. His eyes fairly glittered as he spoke, and he put his hand over his heart and bowed as if to some applauding crowd conjured up by his imagination. You are to be congratulated, I remarked, considerably surprised at his enthusiasm. There was the case of von Bischoff of Frankfurt last year. He would certainly have been hung had his test been in existence. There was Mason of Bradford, and the notorious Mueller, and Lefevre of Montpellier, and Samson of New Orleans. I can name a score of cases in which it would have been decisive. You seem to be a walking calendar of crime, said Stamford with a laugh. You might start a paper of those lines, call it the Police News of the Past. Very interesting reading it might be made, too, remarked Sherlock Holmes, sticking a small piece of plaster over the prick on his finger. I have to be careful, he continued, turning to me with a smile, for I dabble with poisons a good deal. He held out his hand as he spoke, and I noticed it was all mottled over with similar pieces of plaster, and discolored with strong acids. We came here on business, said Stamford, sitting down on a high three-legged stool, and pushing another one in my direction with his foot. My friend here wants to take diggings, as you were complaining that you could get no one to go halves with you, I thought that I'd better bring you together. Sherlock Holmes seemed delighted at the idea of sharing his rooms with me. I have my eye on a suite in Baker Street, he said, which would suit us down to the ground. You don't mind the smell of strong tobacco, I hope. I always smoke ships myself, I answered. That's good enough. I generally have chemicals about and occasionally do experiments. Would that annoy you? By no means. Let me see. What are my other shortcomings? I get in the dust at times and don't open my mouth for days on end. You must not think I'm sulky when I do that. Just let me alone, and I'll soon be right. What have you to confess now? It's just as well for two fellows to know the worst of one another before they begin to live together. I laughed at this cross-examination. I keep a bullpup, I said, and I object to rows, because my nerves are shaken, and I get up at all sorts of ungodly hours, and I am extremely lazy. I have another set of vices when I'm well, but those are the principal ones at present. Do you include violin playing in your category of rows? He asked anxiously. It depends on the player, I answered. A well-played violin is a treat for the gods, a badly played one. Oh, that's all right, he cried, with a merry laugh. I think we may consider the thing as settled. That is, if the rooms are agreeable to you. When shall we see them? Call for me here at noon tomorrow, and we'll go together and settle everything, he answered. All right, noon exactly, I said, shaking his hand. We left him working among his chemicals, and we walked together towards my hotel. By the way, I asked suddenly, stopping and turning upon Stanford, how the deuce did he know that I had come from Afghanistan? My companion smiled an enigmatical smile. That's just his little peculiarity, he said. A good many people have wanted to know how he finds things out. Oh, a mystery, is it? I cried, rubbing my hands. This is very poignant. I'm much obliged to you for bringing us together. The proper study of mankind is man, you know. You must study him, then, Stremfer said, as he bade me goodbye. You'll find him a knotty problem, though. I'll wager he learns more about you than you about him. Goodbye. Goodbye, I answered, and strolled on to my hotel, considerably interested in my new acquaintance. We met next day as he had arranged, and inspected the rooms in number 221B Baker Street, of which he had spoken at our meeting. They consisted of a couple of comfortable bedrooms, and a single large airy sitting room, cheerfully furnished and illuminated by two broad windows. So desirable in every way were the apartments, and so moderate did the terms seem divided between us, that the bargain was concluded upon the spot, and we at once entered into possession. That very evening, I moved my things round from the hotel, and on the following morning, Sherlock Holmes followed me with several boxes and portmanteaus. For a day or two, we were busily employed in unpacking and laying out our property to the best advantage. That done, we gradually began to settle down and to accommodate ourselves to our new surroundings. Holmes was certainly not a difficult man to live with. He was quiet in his ways, and his habits were regular. It was rare for him to be up after 10 at night, and he had invariably breakfasted and gone out before I rose in the morning. Sometimes he spent his day at the chemical laboratory, sometimes in the dissecting rooms, and occasionally in long walks, which appeared to take him into the lowest portions of the city. Nothing could exceed his energy when the working fit was upon him, but now and again a reaction would seize him, and for days on end he would lie upon the sofa in the sitting room, hardly uttering a word or moving a muscle from morning to night. On these occasions, I have noticed such a dreamy, vacant expression on his eyes that I might have suspected him of being addicted to the use of some narcotic, had not the temperance and cleanliness of his whole life forbidden such a notion. As the weeks went by, my interest in him and my curiosity as to his aims in life gradually deepened and increased. His very person and appearance were such as to strike the attention of the most casual observer. In the height, he was rather over 6 feet, and so excessively lean that he seemed to be considerably taller. His eyes were sharp and piercing, save during those intervals of torpor to which I have alluded, and his thin, hawk-like nose gave his whole expression an air of alertness and decision. His chin, too, had the prominence and squareness which the mark of man of determination. His hands were invariably blotted with ink and stained with chemicals, yet he was possessed of extraordinary delicacy of touch. As I frequently had occasion to observe when I watched him manipulating his fragile philosophical instruments. The reader may set me down as a hopeless busybody when I confess how much this man stimulated my curiosity, and how often I endeavored to break through the reticence which he showed on all that concerned himself. Before pronouncing judgment, however, be it remembered how objectless my life, and how little there was to engage my attention. My health forbade me from venturing out unless the weather was exceptionally genial, I had no friends who would call upon me and break the monotony of my daily existence. Under these circumstances, I eagerly hailed the little mystery which hung around my companion and spent much of my time in endeavoring to unravel it. He was not studying medicine. He had himself, in reply to a question, confirmed Stamford's opinion upon that point. Neither did he appear to have pursued any course of reading which might fit him for a degree in science or any other recognized portal which would give him an entrance into the learned world. Yet his zeal for certain studies was remarkable, and within eccentric limits, his knowledge was so extraordinarily ample and minute that the observers have fairly astounded me. Surely no man would work so hard or attain such precise information unless he had some definite end in view. Desultory readers are seldom remarkable for the exactness of their learning. No man burdens his mind with small matters unless he has some very good reason for doing so. His ignorance was as remarkable as his knowledge. Of contemporary literature, philosophy, and politics, he appeared to know next to nothing. Upon my quoting Thomas Carlyle, he inquired in the naivest way who he might be and what he had done. My surprise reached a climax, however, when I found anecdotally that he was ignorant of the Copernican theory and of the composition of the solar system. That any civilized human being in the 19th century should not be aware that the Earth traveled around the sun appeared to me such an extraordinary fact that I could hardly realize it. "You appear to be astonished," he said, smiling at my expression of surprise. "Now that I do know it, I shall do my best to forget it." "To forget it?" "You see," he explained, "I consider that a man's brain originally is like a little empty attic, and you have to stock it with such furniture as you choose. A fool takes in all the lumber of every sort that he comes across, so that the knowledge which he might be useful to him gets crowded out, and our best is jumbled up with a lot of other things, so that he has a difficulty in laying his hands upon it. Now the skilled workman is very careful indeed as to what he takes into his brain attic. He will have nothing but the tools which may help him in doing his work, but out of these he has a large assortment, and all in the most perfect order. It is a mistake to think that little room has elastic walls and can distend to any extent. Depend upon it, there comes a time when for every addition of knowledge you forget something that you knew before. It is of the highest importance, therefore, not to have useless facts elbowing out from the useful ones. "But the solar system," I protested. "What the deuce is it to me?" he interrupted impatiently. "You say that we go around the sun. If we ran around the moon, it would not make a pennyworth of difference to me or my work." I was on the point of asking him what that work might be, but something in his manner showed me that the question would be an unwelcome one. I pondered over a short conversation, however, and endeavored to draw my deductions from it. He said that he would acquire no knowledge which did not bear upon his object. Therefore, all the knowledge which he possessed as such was such as would be useful to him. I enumerated in my own mind all the various points upon which he had shown me that he was exceptionally well informed. I even took a pencil and jotted them down. I could not help smiling at the document when I completed it. It ran in this way. Knowledge of literature, nil. Knowledge of philosophy, nil. Knowledge of astronomy, nil. Knowledge of politics, feeble. Knowledge of botany, variable. Well up in belladonna, opium, and poisons generally, knows nothing of practical gardening. Knowledge of genealogy, practical but limited. Tells at a glance different soils from each other. After walks has shown me splashes upon his trousers and told me by their color and consistence in what part of London he had received them. Knowledge of chemistry, profound. Knowledge of anatomy, accurate but unsystematic. Knowledge of sensational literature, immense. He appears to know every detail of every horror perpetrated in the century. Plays the violin well, is an expert single-stick player, boxer, and swordsman, has a good practical knowledge of British law. When I had got so far in my list, I threw it to the fire in despair. If I can only find out what the fellow is driving at by reconciling all these accomplishments and discovering a calling which needs them all, I said to myself, I may as well give up the attempt at once. I see that I have alluded above to his powers upon the violin. These were very remarkable, but as eccentric as all his other accomplishments, that he could play pieces, and difficult pieces, I knew well, because at my request he played me some of Mendelssohn's Lieder and other favorites. When left to himself, however, he would seldom produce any music or attempt any recognized air. Leaning back in his armchair of an evening, he would close his eyes and scrape carelessly at the fiddle which was thrown across his knee. Sometimes the chords were sonorous and melancholy. Occasionally they were fantastic and cheerful. Clearly they reflected the thoughts which possessed him. But whether the music aided those thoughts, or whether the playing was simply the result of a whim or fancy, was more than I could determine. I might have rebelled against these exasperating solos had it not been that he usually terminated them by playing in quick succession a whole series of my favorite airs as a slight compensation for the trial upon my patience. During the first week or so, we had no callers, and I had begun to think that my companion was as friendless a man as myself. Presently, however, I found that he had many acquaintances, and those in the most different classes of society. There was one little, swallow, rat-faced, dark-eyed fellow, who was introduced to me as Mr. Lestrade, who came three or four times in a single week. One morning, a young girl called, fashionably dressed, and stayed for half an hour or more. The same afternoon brought a gray-headed, seedy visitor, looking like a Jew peddler, who appeared to be much excited, and who was closely followed by a slipshod elderly woman. On another occasion, an old white-haired gentleman had an interview with my companion, and on another, a railway porter in his velveteen uniform. When any of these nondescript individuals put in an appearance, Sherlock Holmes used to beg for the use of the sitting room, and I would retire to my bedroom. He always apologized to me for putting me to this inconvenience. I have to use this room as a place of business, he said, and these people are my clients. Again I had an opportunity of asking him a point-blank question, and again my delicacy prevented me from forcing another man to confide in me. I imagine at the time that he felt that he had some strong reason for not alluding to it, but he soon dispelled the idea by coming round to the subject of his own accord. It was upon the 4th of March, as I have good reason to remember, that I rose somewhat earlier than usual, and found that Sherlock Holmes had not yet finished his breakfast. The landlady had become so accustomed to my late habits that my place had not been laid, nor my coffee prepared. With the unreasonable petulance of mankind, I rang the bell and gave a curt intimation that I was ready. When I picked up a magazine from the table and attempted to while away the time with it, while my companion munched silently at his toast, one of the articles had a pencil mark at the heading, and I naturally began to run my eye through it. Its somewhat ambitious title was The Book of Life, and it attempted to show how much an observant man might learn by an accurate and systematic examination of all that came his way. It struck me as being a remarkable mixture of shrewdness and of absurdity. The reasoning was close and intense, but the deductions appeared to me to be far-fetched and exaggerated. The writer claimed, by a momentary expression, a twitch of a muscle or a glance of an eye, to fathom a man's innermost thoughts. Deceit, according to him, was an impossibility in the case of one trained to observation and analysis. His conclusions were as infallible as so many propositions of Euclid. So startling would his results appear to the uninitiated, that until they learned the process by which he had arrived at them, they might well consider him as a necromancer. From a drop of water, said the writer, a logician could infer the possibility of an Atlantic or a Niagara, without having seen or heard one or the other. So all life is a great chain, the nature of which is known whenever we are shown a single link of it. Like all other arts, the science of deduction and analysis is one which can only be acquired by long and patient study. Nor is life long enough to allow any mortal to attain the highest possible perfection in it. Before turning to those mortal and mental aspects of the matter, which present the greatest difficulties, let the inquirer begin by mastering the more elementary problems. Let him, on meeting of a fellow mortal, learn at a glance to distinguish the history of the man and the trade or profession to which he belongs. Puerile as such an exercise may seem, it sharpens the facilities of observation and teaches one where to look and what to look for. By a man's fingernails, by his coat sleeve, by his boot, by his trouser knees, by the calluses of his forefinger and thumb, by his expression, by his shirt cuffs, by each of these things, a man's calling is plainly revealed. That all united should fail to enlighten the competent inquirer in any case is almost inconceivable. What ineffable twaddle, I cried, slapping the magazine down on the table. I never read such rubbish in my life. What is it? Asked Sherlock Holmes. Why, this article, I said, pointing at it with my egg spoon as I sat down to my breakfast. I see that you have read it since you have marked it. I don't deny it was smartly written. It irritates me, though. It is evidently the theory of some armchair lounger who involves all these neat little paradoxes in the seclusion of his own study. It is not practical. I should like to see him clamped down in a third-class carriage on the underground and asked to give the trades of all his fellow travelers. I would lay 1,000 to 1 against him. You would lose your money, Holmes remarked calmly. As for the article, I wrote it myself.
You?
Yes. I have a turn booth for observation and for deduction. The theories which I have expressed there, which appear to you to be so chimerical, are really extremely practical. So practical, I depend upon them for my bread and cheese.
And how? I asked involuntarily.
Well, I have a trade of my own. I suppose I'm the only one in the world. I'm a consulting detective, if you can understand what that is. Here in London, we have lots of government detectives and lots of private ones. When these fellows are at fault, they come to me, and I manage to put them on the right scent. They lay all the evidence before me, and I am generally able, by the help of my knowledge of history and of crime, to set them straight. There is a strong family resemblance about misdeeds, and if you have all the details of 1,000 at your finger ends, it is odds if you can't unravel the 1,001st. Lestrade is a well-known detective. He got himself into a fog recently over a forgery case, and that was what brought him here.
And these other people?
They are mostly sent on by private inquiry agencies. They are all people who are in trouble about something and want a little enlightening. I listen to their story, they listen to my comments, and then I pocket my fee. But do you mean to say, I said, that without leaving your room, you can unravel some knot which other men can make nothing of, although they have seen every detail for themselves?
Quite so. I have a kind of intuition that way. Now and again a case turns up which is a little more complex. Then I have to bustle about and see things with my own eyes. You see, I have a lot of special knowledge which I apply to the problem, and which facilitates matters wonderfully. Those rules of deduction laid down in that article which aroused your scorn are invaluable to me in practical work. Observation with me is second nature. You appeared to be surprised when I told you, on our first meeting, that you had come from Afghanistan.
You were told, no doubt.
Nothing of the sort. I knew you came from Afghanistan. From long habit, the train of thoughts ran so swiftly through my mind that I arrived at the conclusion without being conscious of the immediate steps. There were short steps, however. The train of reasoning ran. Here is a gentleman of medical type, but with the air of a military man. Clearly an army doctor, then. He has just come from the tropics, for his face is dark, and that is not the natural tint of his skin, for his wrists are fair. He has undergone hardship and sickness, and his haggard face says clearly. His left arm has been injured. He holds it in a stiff and unnatural manner. Where in the tropics could an English army doctor have seen much hardship and got his arm wounded? Clearly in Afghanistan. The whole train of thought did not occupy a second. I then remarked that you came from Afghanistan, and you were astonished. It is simple enough as you explain it, I said, smiling. You remind me of Edgar Allan Poe's Dupin. I had no idea that such individuals did exist outside of stories. Sherlock Holmes rose and lit his pipe. No doubt you think that you are complimenting me and comparing me to Dupin, he observed. Now, in my opinion, Dupin was a very inferior fellow. That trick of his of breaking in on his friend's thoughts when an apropos remark after a quarter of an hour's silence is really very shallow and superficial. He had some analytical genius, no doubt, but he was by no means such a phenomenal as Pope appeared to imagine. Have you read Gerberver's work? I asked. Does Lacour come up to your idea of a detective? Sherlock Holmes sniffed sardonically. Lacour was a miserable bungler, he said, in an angry voice. He had only one thing to recommend him, and that was his energy. The book made me positively ill. The question was how to identify an unknown prisoner. I could have done it in 24 hours. Lacour took 6 months or so. I might be made a textbook for detectives to teach them what to avoid. I felt rather indignant as having two characters whom I admired treating in this cavalier style. I walked over to the window and stood looking out into the busy street. This fellow may be very clever, I said to myself, but he is certainly very conceited. There are no crimes and no criminals in these days, he said curiously. There is the use of having brains in our profession. I know well that I have it in me to make my name famous. No man lives or has ever lived who has brought the same amount of study and natural talent to detection or crime which I have done. And what is the result? There is no crime to detect, or at most, some bungling villainy with a motive so transparent that even a Scotland Yard official can see through it. I was still annoyed at his bumptious style of conversation. I thought it best to change the topic. I wonder what fellow was looking for. I wonder what that fellow was looking for, I asked, pointing to a stalwart, plainly dressed individual who was walking slowly down the other side of the street, looking anxiously at the numbers. He had a large blue envelope in his hand and was evidently the bearer of a message. You mean the retired sergeant of Marines? Said Sherlock Holmes. Brag and bounce, I thought to myself. He knows that I cannot verify his guess. The thought had hardly passed through my mind when the man whom we were watching caught sight of the number on our door and ran rapidly across the roadway. We heard a loud knock, a deep voice below, and heavy steps ascending the stair. For Mr. Sherlock Holmes, he said, stepping into the room and handing my friend the letter. Here was an opportunity of taking the conceit out of him. He little thought of this when he made the random shot. May I ask, my lad, I said, in the blandest voice, what your trade may be? Commissionaire, sir, he said gruffly. Uniform away of repairs. And you were? I asked, with a slightly malicious glance at my companion. A sergeant, sir. Royal Marine Light Infantry, sir. No answer? Right, sir. He clicked his heels together, raised his hand in a salute, and was gone.